Welcome back, Properly Howard fans. This is our first installment of A Few Good Films. Every film this season has some connection to A Few Good Men. Batman 89, of course, has the Jack connection. Just a word on this before we get going. I have some technical difficulties about halfway through, and my mic switches, and it sounds horrible. So be prepared for that. I do apologize. Make sure you're checking out everything happening at the Lorehounds, so lorehounds.com. You can see their coverage of Dune Prophecy and Silo. Of course, we really appreciate iTunes reviews. We will read it on this podcast if you write one. If you have emails, you can send those to cocoonsofhorror@gmail.com. All right, I hope you enjoy A Few Good Films, our season spotlighting the major players in A Few Good Men.
What about your prime?
What about my prime, Nick?
Welcome to Properly Howard, a podcast that reviews classic films and other pulp fiction. Today we look at the 1989 pop culture phenomenon, Batman. Directed by Tim Burton, Batman pits Michael Keaton against Jack Nicholson while Kim Basinger screams about it. Also, Jack Palance in a gorgeous robe. With me as always is Dr. Anthony LaDon.
You're my number one guy.
Sugar Puffs.
Steve, we've talked about Batman 89. Maybe more than any other movie besides Star Wars, the Star Wars franchise.
Yeah, I think that's probably right.
I mean, I guess you could say more than any other movie, because when we talk about Star Wars, it's sort of like a broad swath of narrative. Whereas
right.
Mostly we just talk about this movie. I haven't seen Batman Returns in, I guess, more than a decade.
Yeah, and that's a go-to for me. Sometimes I'll skip right over 89.
Oh, man. So we've talked a lot about Fat Man.
Fat Man, yeah.
We've talked a lot about Batman. And I have a question for you that we've never discussed.
Okay.
So I'm kind of excited to hear your answer to this. Is the Joker a clown?
The Joker a clown? Well, I mean,
is the Joker a clown?
Well, isn't he like the clown prince of like mayhem or something? I mean, isn't that kind of how he's described?
Something like that. I mean, as far as I know, does he
qualify? Yeah, this is a hot dog a sandwich question.
Yes, that's right. Does he qualify as a clown?
Wow, this is great. I really hope the people tuning in are going to appreciate us breaking down what qualifies as clowning. You know, cause on, you know, you could simply say, look, just because I put on, black clothing and a black hood does not a ninja make, right? Like there's other...
Billy Joel can dress up like a mechanic all he wants.
Right. Yeah.
I'm not bringing
my car to him. Right.
All right, so yes, is the Joker a clown?
So okay, let's find out. What is a clown? What makes a clown? Does a clown have to have makeup?
At least a little bit. And I'm saying just a little bit of face makeup, right?
So you're saying just maybe some like J.D. Vance-esque mascara is enough.
No, you have to have more than a news anchor. I'm suggesting that it matters what the makeup is doing and where it's positioned, but you at least have to have some kind of bright color on your face, I think.
Okay, well, this is going to be a very long podcast, and I think it's going to be worth it. Are you familiar with the song?
A clown needs to have clown makeup. That's what I'm saying.
Are you familiar with the song, Don't Worry, Be Happy?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, I don't need to give you a lot of backstory on
this was a family favorite for years. Yes.
Bobby McFerrin. I believe this is like maybe the first a cappella song to win a Grammy or something. I mean, don't quote me on that, but it's definitely
also the first song that both my father and I enjoyed at the same time.
This is a great bonding experience. Are you familiar with the music video starring Bobby McFerrin?
Unfortunately, was he a mime? I'm not sure. I have a vague memory of this.
So the music video for Bobby McFerrin featured Robin Williams.
By the way, I want you to know that I know that mimes don't usually sing a cappella.
Good. That would be amazing. They're like, hey, Bobby, you know that song you're known for where you do like not just the singing, but like you actually use your voice in many other ways to simulate instruments? Some say that's the opposite of miming, like almost to the extreme end of the mime spectrum.
I'm so glad we're talking about Bobby McFerrin right now.
Could you be a mime in the video? Like,
all right, I don't remember the video. I'm going to look it up after we talk, but tell me about this video and how it relates.
So in this video, there are, you know, representations of things that aren't going well and then ways you can just be happy, which, by the way, I mean, what great advice. I mean, this is really before we understood clinical depression to the degree that we do now, right? I mean, could you imagine your therapist, you come in, you're just like, man, I'm having suicidal thoughts. I just really feel like I'm just not making it in this world. My family seems to really be detaching from me. And I don't know if it's me detaching from them. I said, have you tried not worrying about it? And instead being happy. So Bobby McFerrin, Robin Williams, and Bill Irwin. I don't know if you're familiar with Bill Irwin.
Was he a mime?
Yeah, well, in this particular, you know what? That's a great question. I think Bill Irwin might actually qualify.
He's done some miming work. I was way off. He's done some miming work.
He's considered a clown. Now, as a clown, there are instances where he is for sure in like that white makeup, you know, where you're just white faced and like the black fedora type thing and big old baggy jammies. I think that's like, I don't know if that's the French clown or just, which, by the way, we need to depict that clown in scary movies more. Maybe a clown that takes himself too seriously. Like, that's a horror trope.
No. See, the Americas have really embraced the hobo clown more than anything.
Yes, the sad clown.
Uh-huh.
Bill Irwin in this particular video is doing an awful lot of clowning, like what I would consider clown work, and like whether it's in the world of miming or if those two are kind of have some nice Venn diagram overlap. No makeup, right? And I would look at him and say, oh, he's clowning around.
This guy
qualifies as a clown, but he's doing so without the makeup, right? And so I think this brings us to an interesting point of the Joker in this particular film, because he is what we would consider adorned in makeup, but it turns out that it's the regular face that is his makeup, because this origin story has him, his nerves were severed and he went into toxic waste and it made his hair green and it made his face white, and he has to put on fleshy makeup to sort of be amongst the masses.
Mm-hmm.
So I think... I'm going to go so far as to say that clowning is a state of mind.
Well, I just want to wrap up our Bill Irwin conversation before we go to your more epistemological.
I have no problem just talking about Bill Irwin.
He began as a vaudeville style stage performer and has been noted for his contributions to the Renaissance of American circus. During the 1970s.
Did you know that there was a circus renaissance?
I'm finding that out now. He's also known as Mr. Noodle on Sesame Street, Elmo's World. He seems to be a formally trained clown. All right. So let's just put that to rest right now.
So he's a clown.
Not marginally a clown. He is a clown.
He might be, he's sort of the sort of apex clown.
I'm gonna disagree there, but let's continue with the Joker. No, this follows. I have a follow-up question for you. But
now I'm remembering him in the movie Popeye, also with Robin Williams. I think he keeps kicking his hat. He goes to always trying to get his hat and he keeps kicking it. And like, he gets like he does a lot of physical stuff in there. Again, no makeup.
That's the kind of thing that you should not worry about, by the way. Doctor, can you help me? I'm perpetually kicking my own hat.
Are you a clown?
All right.
Formally
so,
trained, but I mean.
Okay, so this gets to my next question for you about the
did
Joker.
We answer the first question.
I think that I okay. So here's here. Let me
answer your question with a question, and by that I mean more information about a different person.
No, this is back to Batman. So I think that you can make the case that the Joker. In the modern world, well, you know, the clown renaissance has come and gone.
well, at least the circus renaissance.
the Joker is the most famous clown.
Hmm.
Outpacing Bill Irwin, outpacing Bozo, outpacing even Zach Galifianakis. I think that the Joker is the most famous clown, and yet... Not really a clown. Not really a clown.
Hmm.
You know, he's the visual for the Joker in the 1940s was originally inspired by a deck of cards. So
sure.
The face of a clown is on a deck of cards, right?
Right.
So that's a clown. But the Joker has no formal clown training. He doesn't really put on makeup to make him look clownish. That's just his skin.
In the movie.
In the movie. And in the movie, what is his backstory? His backstory that would make him kind of a villainous clown is that he has a lucky deck of cards.
Mm-hmm.
Those are his clown bona fides. It would be like me becoming a supervillain based on wiffle ball because I've got a favorite wiffle ball that I hold lower podcast.
The Whiffler.
The Whiffler. It's absurd. It's absurd. And I would say that he is both the most famous clown in the world and not really a clown. It's kind of a paradox, this guy.
Imagine... falling into toxic waste, like RoboCop's toxic waste situation, very different than Burton's Batman.
Mm-hmm. Both critical to the origin story, by the way. But let's continue.
So he falls into toxic waste, and it makes him clownish. Changes it makes him look like he's got, you know, permanent makeup, mm-hmm. and he becomes a bit of a goofball.
Well, I think that this is interesting because I think that what this movie is trying to tell us is that his face was in danger of just slipping right off, but the plastic surgeon, who I love that he's almost a Nazi scientist, yeah. Who I don't think specializes in facial reconstruction based on the outcome.
Why did he have to go to this guy?
That he was able to pin his face into place in a way that made him look a little bit like a Joker on his lucky deck of cards. And that was enough. That was enough for him to just embrace the identity.
Oh, so you think that he's like, well, I'm this now, so I might as well put on the whole affect.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's possible that he had somewhere deep down inside him, like I identify with this one card in my deck of 53 cards.
Yeah, I
but
think
we don't
I
get see. Any of that. All we know is that he has a lucky deck of cards. Why doesn't he?
I got the sense. I got the sense that this is a good point. That I got the sense that this modified his mentality because he seemed to be really like. So you're saying that this was a choice to lean into this? That maybe it was somehow lurking. I mean, I don't know. I mean, he does a lot of dancing around. He sings. We got none of that in the original version of Jack Napier. We just got like, I didn't ask. And you got little things like that. But then later he's like, oh, it's going to be a hot time in the city tonight.
Yeah, I don't see any of sort of that latent clownishness in the original character. But somehow being dropped in a vat of goo and employing out of nowhere? Like, where does this Nazi?
Yeah, so I mean, basically, being a Gus Grissom henchman does not come with medical benefits. That's like one takeaway for sure. Or he has Kaiser. Like, I don't. It's just one or the other.
So originally, in the original comic, Joker has no origin story, but Burton decided to go a different direction. He decided to show us almost a fully formed Batman. I just dropped my wiffle ball, by the way. he shows us a fully formed Batman, but then he really leans into the Joker origin story. Do you think that this is a good idea? Because I think that we've established it's kind of an absurd origin story.
I think it's a very specific choice, right? Because, again, as we talked about, the Batman phenomenon was, you know, we were kind of jonesing for superhero stuff, right? And it was very, we were being introduced to maybe a more adult version of superheroes, more sinister themes.
Yeah, I think this could be the first adult superhero movie. I mean, I don't know how adult it is. It's kind of wacky.
It's as much for adults as it is for. I mean, kids can maybe enjoy it, but right. It is much darker than any of the Superman films up to this point. So it is interesting because I don't know. Like they give us a sense of the Batman. Origin, but it's still tied to the Joker. Like even Batman's mm-hmm. little flashback of him, you know, of his parents dying, and we just kind of, you know, that's just something we just know. Mm-hmm. But it still is now still shaping the character of the Joker. I mean, the Joker. This movie could easily been called the Joker, right? I mean,
yeah.
I mean, obviously Nicholson gets top billing because he's a bigger actor, and I wonder how much of that. I mean. Was this the story, or when once Nicholson signed on, was it more like, hey, we got to lean into the fact that they, like, did Nicholson move this needle maybe even more so post, you know, post casting mm-hmm. than, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's a very interesting approach. And I think that's one of the things that comes out of that later is that, like, even Returns and then the rest of sort of that first quadrilogy, if you want to connect them all together, really is focused on origins of all these super or these villains. Like Batman is kind of a given. We live in a world where Batman exists, and let's find out how do we like it's Batman getting his biggest challenges because right. Batman and then Batman kind of gets short shrift in to some degree. I mean, you know, Keaton is I still think he's great, but like we don't get the tortured Batman like we do later.
And it's interesting because I think that it's almost like Nicholson hams it up more than he has in any other role. And Keaton, at this point, was kind of known for being a ham. And he really kind of tries to play it a little bit more subdued.
He's kind of a little bit... not quite smoldering, but definitely under the surface.
Yeah, yeah. And it does come out, like he's got some comedic moments in this film. But like you said, very much overshadowed by the Joker. And I wonder if that isn't kind of a genius move on Burton's part, because set against the Joker, Batman seems a little bit less silly in this right. film. It's almost like Gotham City is almost silly.
Right.
Batman is the least silly part of Gotham City in this
yeah.
film.
Yeah, which is kind of cool. Now that when we talked about like, Burton just says, this is a world where Batman can exist, so buckle up.
Yeah.
And in doing so, I think that is kind of the way it approaches, like Batman becomes real because everything else is so fanciful. So instead of trying to ground Batman into our world to make him make sense to us, it kind of flips the entire perspective to where mm-hmm. it's like, yeah, Batman's trying to like rein in this madness.
It's almost like this whole film is a funhouse mirror. And when Batman enters, you're like, guy in a bat costume.
I hope he's got something on his jet that can collect giant balloons.
Sweet. shop the best Black Friday weekend deals up to 70% off only at Tanger Outlets. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Coach, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and hundreds more. Find something for everyone on your list during our biggest sale of the year. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Stores open at 6 a.m. Black Friday. Get your savings at Tanger.com.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
Batman was such a big deal. This was, like I said, we've seen blockbusters up until this point, so we've been conditioned to it. But this was different. Like, this was the it almost felt like we were told Batman was coming out. Like, it felt like 5 years in advance. And all we did was wait.
Mm-hmm.
I know it wasn't that long, but I mean, you couldn't go anywhere without seeing like Batman shirts. Like, every single department store had them, but they were selling out at like a record clip. Anything but the Batman, it was just the symbol. Get a Batman poster that was just the symbol, because that was almost enough to spark a lot of interest. Because the last time we saw Batman, and you not so much, but like I know for me, was the campy series. So a lot of people were thinking, oh, it's going to be that. And at one point, I think it was. I think the studio had Bill Murray lined up to be Batman, because I think they were going to follow that same sort of campy approach, which is kind of fascinating because that was a specific choice made by like the television studio. It's not like Batman comic books were goofy necessarily. I mean, the fact that his address is a bat fighting, like, you know, people made of clay, but it's not like it necessarily had a notoriously goofball tone. So it's funny how the pop culture impact of the Batman series sort of framed everybody's perception of Batman. So the idea that there was going to be a dark or more gothic Batman movie was very intriguing to people. People were really taken aback. Like, that doesn't make sense. Batman's only silly. And so I think that's one of the things to the studio was gambling against, is can we play Batman off type? Because for the majority of people, you know, the non-comic book fans, mm-hmm. Batman's a comedy, or it's supposed to be silly. So the idea that that it could be trying to take it seriously was very, you know, it was this almost this enigma that people couldn't quite figure out. And so you had that level of anticipation. Tim Burton is a pretty hot name. When they got Nicholson, it was like, whoa, this has got like gravity. And then there was the big controversy. They're picking Mr. Mom.
But as soon as it was out, almost immediately, Keaton was beloved.
Right. It seems like for most people, it was like, of course. And I think a lot of that has to do with the Bruce Wayne factor. And I like Keaton in the sense that they give you a fair amount. I mean, considering how much Batman's in it, they give you a fair amount of Bruce Wayne. And while later films work so hard to really get the brooding billionaire, mm-hmm. This one is it doesn't give us a lot about Bruce Wayne, like maybe the deep psyche, but we get a lot of just him being just good at being Batman.
Well, so his like, Bruce Wayne is like, he's more eccentric than anything else. He's like, I've got all this wealth and I don't know what to do with it. I'm going to travel the world and purchase various suits of armor and maybe not ever go into certain rooms of his house.
Right.
His best friend is his butler, who's also his surrogate father. And he's almost just quirky more than he is brooding. He's quiet, and Keaton always has this thing with his eyes. Like, he's got very interesting eyes. Almost like I can tell that you're charismatic, but I'm kind of worried that you're a little bit crazy too.
Right. And I think that's an interesting point that you bring up. Like, the eyes of Batman are super important. And I think Keaton's eyes, even as Batman in this impossibly uncomfortable suit, the thickest layer of rubber. I mean, those are like, it's as thick as like ATV tires. I mean, it is, it's insane how completely non-functional this outfit is.
Mm-hmm.
And like every close up just makes it so much worse. I'm like, that is like, is that like 3-inch thick rubber? Like, what's going on here? Like steel belted. I believe it's bulletproof. But I mean, his eyes do a lot. And but what's interesting is like we get so many other Batman, and like, so I want to go back to a point that you made, and I think it's really key every time I revisit this, and I do revisit this movie quite a bit. And I think I'm more fascinated by it maybe than I am like a fan. I mean, I am a fan. I do enjoy it. But because of what a pop culture touchstone this was, especially for us at that age. And just, I mean, the whole nation was wrapped in Batman fever. And so it almost felt like no matter what it was, what was going to come out, people were going to be a little bit like, maybe felt a little disappointed. Because the movie does a lot of things that newer Batman movies don't.
Mm-hmm.
And it ignores a lot of things that a lot of newer Batman movies focus on. And in this version of Bruce Wayne Batman, it's eccentric billionaire who also happens to be Batman, as opposed to tortured soul who must become Batman.
Right. Well, they kind of nod to the childhood trauma in this.
Sure.
But you don't, I mean, Batman Begins is kind of an entire meal served with that particular dish.
Right.
In 89 Batman, it's like Batman's been established as this night terror vigilante or creature or something. But it feels like Bruce Wayne has been Bruce Wayne for a very long time. So much so that Alfred is not thrilled with this particular life choice.
Right.
In this movie, every chance that Alfred gets to blow up Wayne's spot, he's going to take it. He's going to tell Vicki Vale that they weren't really going to go out of town.
Yeah.
He's going to bring her to the Batcave without permission.
Amazing butler, horrible wingman.
Okay. Steve, I have dredged up the Batagories, which we developed for Matt Reeves' The Batman. And the first of these categories is the depravity of Gotham City. In 2024, we've seen maybe more than half a dozen iterations of Gotham City. Does Burton's Gotham City meet or exceed your expectations for the depravity of Gotham?
Oh, okay. I'm going to say yeah. I think it's fine.
I like it a lot. And it could be nostalgia, but for me, that first wide shot of Gotham City, it is so original. It's not New York. It's not Chicago. It's like this hybrid, you know, cartoon model, comic booky Hollywood studio set concocted in Tim Burton's weird mind.
I like that we start off with what we think is going to be Bruce Wayne's origin story, and it's not. Showing that Gotham hasn't changed. And essentially you have a moment where Batman is taking care of his own past by confronting these guys, mm-hmm. right? It's a dark place. It's a wild place. And I think it does a good job, like you said, by having sort of that combo of kind of cartoon, kind of model, kind of real, but definitely it feels fictional. As soon as you do that, as soon as you create this clearly fictional world, I think you allow yourself to have Batman exist.
You need a setting that makes sense of a billionaire in a cowl.
Right. And I wonder, in it, watching this movie, and then again, I enjoy almost every Batman movie I've seen. Almost, because Batman versus Superman exists. It's the more real Gotham becomes, the more unrealistic Batman makes, you know, it becomes as well, right? I mean,
well, the less iconic superhero mystique Batman can have.
In fact, in the movies spend so much time trying to convince me that Batman could exist that I'm missing out on Batman existing.
So if you're like Nolan, and I enjoy Nolan to a certain extent, but if you're like Nolan and you want to go for hyperrealism, then what you got to do is you got to put, you know, Batman in a military frogman suit, and his suit is for the purpose of tactical utility, which is fine. That's interesting to me. Eventually, we're going to want to see the cowl and cape.
And it also creates a problem with the villains. Because if you go through a lot of effort to make Batman real and the concept of Batman real, then you start to limit what else you can do and introduce, right? Like, you start to like tick off a bunch of Batman villains from the comics and the, you know.
Yeah, you might not get a Penguin Man piloting a submarine.
Right. Whereas I think Tim Burton does a really fun job of saying, look, this is a world where Batman exists. So not necessarily anything goes. But like, if Superman showed up, I think I'd be okay with it. Like, you can't see, like, and I know that's what Zack Snyder was trying to do with Batman versus Superman and Justice League and everything, was like trying to, well, let's kind of sci-fi it up, which, you know, I think it's an approach that could work. Mm-hmm. It has to be pretty intentional, right? So it's, we're starting to get so conditioned to the idea of Batman being this grounded, hyper-real character that we lose some of the magic. And I feel like Tim Burton does a really good job of letting them, like, the Joker just has stuff with his logo on it. And why wouldn't he?
And why not?
Why not?
Okay, so I want to ask you this next one, because this does lead back to the bat suit. Every Batman movie has a scene where Batman emerges from the shadows, and usually this is the first reveal of the bat suit. Burton's version of this is a little bit funny, because Batman is trying to be spooky more than anything else.
Yeah.
He's got some gadgets that allow him to look like he's hovering. And when he menaces the criminals of Gotham City, there's just a lot of arm raising. And that arm raising causes these criminals to just go insane.
Psychological warfare, man. Give them credit.
The fear of this bat suit is too much to take. They break down psychologically. But what about you, Steve? How did the Batman emerges from the shadow scene hold up in your estimation? Did you break down psychologically?
And again, this is one of the things where it's like I look back through the lens of all the other ones and like how dramatic and like he comes in like powerful in the other film.
Mm-hmm.
But this one makes sense to me. It also kind of sets a tone that says, look, this is he's frightening in a theatrical way. And
he's all cape. He is all cape.
Yeah. Well, he can't turn his head, so that helps. definitely it does. Is it the goofiest of all the Batmans we've seen? But in the context of this world, in the context of this Gotham City, he just comes just sort of majestically, you know, gliding in, and then they don't know what to do with him, and he just raises it up, and the reason why I think it works is because, hey, everybody, he's dressed as a bat. He's a human person dressed as a bat. And it would be weird if he didn't try to show that off a little bit. You know, we want our later Batmans to be like, oh, yeah, and I mean, he's dressed as a bat. But like, if you think about it psychologically, he's actually scared of bats. So what he's trying to do is he's trying to harness his own fear. So that's why he has a pointy hat on. That makes perfect sense. And he has a cape. Well, the cape serves a different function. Like in this case, it's like, no, I'm dressed as a bat. I'm Batman. I have an insignia that's, you know, bright yellow. I'm a bat. Look at me. I'm a bat. Yeah, that's exactly what this Batman should do.
All right. I'm going to say, in retrospect, this could have been done differently. You don't need to show off your cape. I really do feel like you look like a freak. You look like you're in a costume. Raising your arms above your head to really accentuate the bat wings over the top. Not necessary. Act like you've been here before, Bruce.
He's letting it be known. I mean, so right now he's rumor, right?
Oh, sure, because they don't, some of the street toughs don't even believe he exists.
Right. So he takes this opportunity to tell the guy, look, I want you to tell all your friends about me.
Mm-hmm.
And which is, you know, nice that he has so many friends.
So that's the third category here, third category, if you will. Batman freaks out a street tough. And for me, this was spot on. This was perfect. We get the iconic I'm Batman in the growly voice, which he doesn't keep up over the entire movie.
Right.
But just that iconic, menacing Batman voice freaks him out. He really freaks him out, too. I mean, they probably are taken directly to Arkham Asylum. So this one absolutely is a yes for me. What about you?
Yeah, I'm all in on it. It's to me, that is the gold standard. And so anytime Batman has that moment, like I'm always comparing it to this one because it was such an iconic moment in a film that was, again, so highly anticipated and it was so, everybody was excited for it. You know, I'm Batman, you know, so now it's like, all right, rumor's done. Now you know what to call me. Tell all your friends about me. You know, there's a new sheriff in town.
Yeah, and the choice to be a little bit raspy in the scene creates an entire career for Will Arnett. like Will Arnett does not exist if Keaton decides to go a different direction with this bat voice. All right, next category. Batman deals with childhood trauma.
I think it's okay. I mean, obviously, this is the first one we get a chance to see. And so I think we get a better the childhood trauma is important for us to understand kind of why he's Batman. But more importantly, the biggest part of the reveal in this is that the Joker killed his parents. Definitely feels like it's more about what this relationship currently is.
And on rewatch, I forgot that they used a younger actor who kind of looks like Nicholson to play that role. And this really worked for me. I was like, oh, they didn't try to de-age him. They didn't try to, like, you know, tape his cheeks up like Joe Pesci and My Cousin Vinny. Like, they just chose an actor that believably looks like a young Nicholson. So I was really thrilled with this. I like this a lot. And I'll be honest, I'm not really all that interested in the childhood trauma of my superheroes. I like origin stories, but I don't want you to like make a whole meal out of the childhood trauma. So I think this was just the right amount. All right, fifth category. Usually in a Batman movie, we'll see a new bat gadget revealed. Sometimes it's on his belt. Sometimes it's just some bit of technology that he has. What gadget in this film serves that purpose for you?
Well, I mean, to some degree, all of it, right? Because this is our first Batman film. But there are
We have seen grappling hooks before.
Right. The Batplane is new.
Batplane is new. The way the Batplane looks, it's fantastic.
Keep in mind, this logo is very like movie specific, right? Like if you look at the way the bat symbol has changed over all the different films, this one's perfect for marketing.
There are moments in films that I wait for. Like there are just certain moments, like iconic moments in films that I wait for. And one of the moments that I'm anticipating, I know it's coming, I can't wait to see it, it never disappoints. It's when the Batplane zips up and hangs for just a moment over the full moon to create that iconic bat symbol.
Right.
I love that scene. I love it every time.
I do too.
It never gets old. My bat gadget was also plane related. It was the balloon pincers.
Very serendipitous to have those.
Yes. The bat plane just happens to have these two little like wire clippers at the front of the plane that are perfect for collecting wires, taking them up into the air, clipping them so that the balloons fly away.
Well, but I always like the idea too that like those pincers were already there.
Yeah.
And they were, but they were for a different purpose. And it, you know, he's like, oh, cool. I'll use these pincers for this.
Hedges, the really tall hedges at right. Gotham Manor.
I'll actually say I think the biggest gadget in this film is the suit.
I think at this point we hadn't thought of Batman as wearing like Kevlar or something like that.
Yeah, Batman, like if we just go into the series, it's tights. It's the similar thing as Superman, right? Like he's wearing body, the shape to his body, spandex and cape and a mask. So this was like, that was, I think, a big deal. I mean, I remember when the first images leaked of him in the suit, you're like, whoa, first off, all black. He's been gray and blue. So that was a huge difference. Like, still keeping the utility belt, which is awesome. Still has the cape, still has the cowl, but the idea that the flare, you know, on his gloves actually can like stop blades in case, you know, there's a ninja Joker henchman. And and so like that scene was awesome. So I think to me that more than all the grappling hooks and stuff, which was kind of expected, the suit was functional. And I think that maybe was the biggest gadget reveal for this film.
Right. All right. I like that a lot. Sixth category, the relationship with Gordon. Now, this film doesn't really do it. We don't really see the bat signal until the end of the film.
Right.
So this film is not interested in establishing a relationship between Gordon and Batman. And so because it's not really trying to do that, I feel like it's almost a non-applicable category.
Right. Well, and I did find it interesting how like Commissioner Gordon plays it. I mean, he's always a big role. He's a big figure. They didn't get necessarily a big name to play Gordon. Which almost suggests that they don't like, maybe Tim Burton didn't see the relationship with Gordon as integral. Integral as maybe other iterations do later, where it's like, yeah, he's the guy, he's the contact, but like there's nothing, you know. So I just noticed by the casting choice, it seemed as though it was like, yeah, no, he's an important part, but to the degree that Batman has contact with the police. As opposed to, you know, some sort of deeper relationship.
Well, and he's also kind of serves as the there is one cop who's not dirty in Gotham.
Right. There's someone he can trust. It's definitely a theme, right? I mean, all of them have crooked cops, all Batman movies.
Next one, the Alfred relationship. For me, I think that Michael Caine is probably the best Alfred at this point.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is an interesting Alfred. I mean, he's not your garden variety butler. But they're not doing kind of like he used to be a badass himself. You know, that more recent movies have done this.
Right.
He's just a cheeky old guy who, you know, makes sure that the bar is well stocked and that Vicki Vale finds the Batcave.
Again, this is one I think this is an area I think that does improve later with other films, is because he has to serve not only as kind of a surrogate father, but almost a conscience, right? And their relationship in this doesn't feel nearly as close. I mean, close in the sense of almost maybe just proximity and experience, but not necessarily. Maybe relationship wise, it's an odd one.
He's almost a matchmaker in this film. It's like, you know, you don't really need a love interest for a Batman movie to work, but Vicki Vale is very important to this movie. And I guess Kim Basinger is the perfect person for this, because in this movie, you just see a photo of her and you fall in love. Like, Vicky Vale has the greatest power of any person in this movie. Whatever room she walks into, men just fall in love with her.
Yeah, Robert Wallace is over the moon.
But here's the problem. If you don't have Alfred to kind of mediate the relationship, why does that first date work?
Right.
I've often found that if I'm on a first date and it's not working, what I need is an old man to come in the room.
Always.
And just...
Old man on speed dial.
Entertain my my special gal with droll stories.
Perfect.
The Batmobile. I'll go first on this one.
Okay.
We saw the Batmobile before the movie came out, right?
I believe so. Yeah, I think if you were watching
it, I think that there was like you could win the Batmobile with it was some kind of contest through MTV. The thing that was most impressive to me is the shield scene.
Oh, yeah.
When he's running away from the Batmobile and the crowd's all around it and he just says shield. Does he say into his cowl, into his wrist? I don't know where.
He's got like a little remote something or other.
He's got a remote something or other, and then the entire vehicle goes into like a tortoise shell. I just thought that was the coolest thing I'd ever seen.
Yeah, no, that Batmobile is, it's the Batmobile by which I think all other Batmobiles must be judged.
For me, that's sort of the platonic ideal of a Batmobile.
There's nothing quite like it. I mean, and also, there's nothing like it. You know what I mean? In the Nolan verse, you've got, like, it's kind of like a tank, right? Essentially. And I mean, I understand there's a lot of pressure to come up with a unique Batmobile. And it is, I mean, it's certainly unique. I mean, there's no question about it. And it fits that world. Like these Batmobiles fit their world. And this one fits this world amazingly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In fact, Burton's vision of what Gotham City should be, and then everything around it just makes sense. Like he creates a kind of self-contained universe that is, in a way though, like this is the universe where by the time we get to Batman Returns, I'm like, yep, Army of Penguins makes sense.
Next category, Bruce Wayne's currency as a social elite. All right. Now for my money, Keaton's the best at this. I totally believe when we meet him at that party for the first time, this guy just kind of works in that role. So to have someone that can actually pull off the Bruce Wayne thing and the Batman thing is kind of amazing. So I think an underrated bit of this movie is this scene between Keaton and Basinger.
You know how people have different sides to their personality?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes a person will have to actually lead a different life.
Oh my God, you're married.
No, I'm not married.
Takes off the overcoat.
You see, my life is really complex. All right, listen. You know how a normal person gets...
I just love to hear him fumble over trying to explain why it would make any sense at all for a billionaire to go out at night dressed up like a big bat.
Right. It's almost one of these things where it's like, you know, I'm about to say out loud that I dress up as a bat, like on the regular.
Like not at Halloween.
Right. And I like that. And I think this scene serves as a jumping off point for like every other Batman movie from this point forward, because it's like it's trying to make this conversation make sense.
Yeah, you're making the entire movie out of this conversation.
Yeah, and whereas this movie is just like, I'm not going to tell you how the Frankenstein monster was made. It's just here.
Deal with it.
That's the interesting part.
Okay, so here's, I did want to ask you another question. So these two fall in love very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is almost a, I mean, in many ways, this is a very, very, this is a movie with very old-fashioned sensibilities. I guess everyone's wearing fedoras, so that's one thing.
Yeah.
So it's a movie that exists in a world with both prints and fedoras. So you've got that.
It's a good world. It feels like it's maybe owned and operated by Bruno Mars, but
but they have one date. Like, she's expecting a lot from one date, and Alfred's expecting like maybe they're going to get married after one date. I'm wondering if this relationship actually makes sense to you.
I mean, he's a billionaire.
He does have those Michael Keaton eyes.
Yeah.
You could put up with a lot.
Yeah, I mean, they love each other immediately. And I mean, it is one of those things where it does feel, it almost feels like there was a needed formula in the late 80s. It's like, okay, you got to have a love story. That's going to help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I don't, and so I think the part for me that's a, maybe takes me a little bit out of it is like, well, they don't have to be like this in love, right? He's coming out of like being reclusive.
Right. let's not sleep on the fact that this is a recluse.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, sure, he treats himself like a bat. Like, everyone's got their kink. Let's not forget the fact that this guy is very antisocial.
Yeah. And the crazy thing is he never leaves his house, but also doesn't go into a bunch of it.
He prefers to hang out in the caves below the house.
Right.
All right. So
he wears rubber.
Batman reflects on his vigilantism. I think that the closest thing that we get to this is this conversation with Vicki Vale, because he's trying to explain it to himself as much as he is to her.
Right.
You know, like, you know, this is normal for me, but, you know, everyone's kind of got a little duality in their life, right? Next category, Batman meets an equal or more powerful vigilante.
Gotham City always brings a smile to my face. Moving freak. Terrorizes. Wait till they get a load of me.
Love that line.
Oh man.
Just the face, the eyes. And one of the biggest knocks on this film was, well, Jack Nicholson's just plain Jack Nicholson. And I'm thinking, that's what you want out of him. Like, why would you want something else from him?
Oh yeah. And I would argue that yes, he's, you know, he's definitely being Nicholson, but like he's getting to be his favorite part of being Jack Nicholson, right? Like he gets to just be like he gets like the keys to his own you know ego and mind, and he just
yeah.
and it's like you know who does Jack Nicholson the best? Jack Nicholson. Watch.
He's so great. He's having so much fun in this film. It's hard not to root for him.
Right. And that's the thing, too, that's really fascinating, too, is that he does play him with a fair amount of dark humor, actual humor. Like, he really shows some comedy chops. He's like, yay, I'm the Joker. Like, it's there's a genuine glee. Never touch another, or never rub another man's rhubarb is one of my absolute favorite lines.
He's got so many great lines in this. I think that Ledger almost edges out both Joaquin Phoenix and Nicholson, but I think it just in terms of like for my own enjoyment, it's Nicholson.
I agree, and but I also think that like the Batmobiles, they were the right Jokers for the world they were in.
Mm-hmm.
The nihilistic sort of chaos agent of Heath Ledger's in the world of the Dark Knight makes way more sense in that world than you couldn't put Nicholson's Joker there.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously. Mm-hmm. I mean, just for a variety of reasons, but like, I think just because of there's a camp factor, there's There's a different level of humor that goes on here. And then of course, Phoenix's Joker lives in a Joker centric world where Batman is, not even realized yet. Right.
That's right. And the other thing I was going to say about Nicholson is because he is so over the top and because he's hamming it up and he's almost like cranking it to 11 in every scene, it almost makes a guy in a bat suit feel a little bit less over the top.
Right. Yeah, I would agree with that. There's a lot of really cool things, I think, that Burton does with the idea that he now looks like this. You know, it gives him a way different origin story than I think anybody else has done. Mm-hmm. So Burton takes a lot of non-Batman-y liberties, which is interesting because I know that like there's some problems that people have, obviously, because Tim Burton's Batman Kills doesn't have a problem with it. There's not that.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that. You're right about that.
And yeah, and it's...
There's that one henchman that looks a lot like Ray Charles, who actually does really well. You know, they're the top of the church tower.
Mm-hmm.
And the Ray Charles guy is just kicking his ass.
Yeah.
And then he ends up hucking the guy. Well, he bonks him with the bell.
And grabs him with the legs, right?
And then his
boot
hoists pictures. Him down the vault. Unfortunately, in Burton's universe, Ray Charles was not around to participate in We Are the World.
So, it's just the way it goes.
Unfortunately. But luckily, Prince is still around.
That's right. So he can maybe he'll have another shot at it.
Okay, final category. Batman brings hope to Gotham City. I think that this one does the best out of any Batman movie for me. Because the bat signal is introduced and it's like, now we got a solution. You know, we this guy's a friend of the city. This is the bat signal. As long as it's not a clear night and it's cloudy, we can defeat all of the criminals.
Summer is the time.
If you're the Penguin, just make a career out of summer.
That's right.
Steve, is this movie better, worse, or on par with a Ron Howard?
Oh, I think it's a Howard +3. There are, I think, maybe some storytelling elements that maybe feel properly Howard, but I just think visually and how ambitious it is, I think it's it exceeds.
Yeah, I can't imagine anyone but Burton. So Howard plus, I was going to say Howard +2, but I could see Howard +3. This is a movie that I think, because I just recently watched Beetlejuice, the original Beetlejuice, for the first time. And I enjoyed it. But for me, this is Burton at his best. It's sort of Burton at the height of his powers. And I think that you might want to make a case for Batman Returns.
Yes, I think Batman Returns is my favorite Batman film.
And you would say that is more Burton.
Because I think what happens is Batman is smash success, obviously, and the studio is like, look, you did it, you got the magic, do it again, and they just let him do it. So everything we get, I mean, Batman Returns is probably closer to a horror film than it is an action. In many ways, there's a lot of grotesque scenes. It's super dark. The origin stories of the Penguin and Catwoman are pretty gnarly. The Penguin's plan, kidnap.
What happened to Vicki Vale in that?
They do make reference to her. I don't think she just can't handle that smoke, essentially.
You're telling me that the one night romance doesn't last for a lifetime?
No. The dynamic between Catwoman and Batman is just pretty great. It's great. Walken is great in it. I really, really enjoy it. But I think that was the problem too, was one of the reasons why You don't get more Burton. It didn't do as well. It did well, but it was also kind of mixed feelings about it because it was so dark. And like, I know McDonald's came under fire because every kid wants the Happy Meal, but not every kid can go see this movie. And so it's, I think you start seeing Tim Burton getting closer to like a Sleepy Hollow type directing, mm-hmm. as opposed to like the Beetlejuice side. So I like it. I mean, I think it's got a great aesthetic. I think it takes a lot of the suit is improved. There's some just incredible visuals in it. I love Batman Returns, and I like this one a lot too. But again, you can have an army of penguins, and you can have a Catwoman that essentially keeps dying and coming back to life because she's got 9 lives, and it's just right. It's just given that that's the case, right? And I like that. I like the idea. It's like, yeah, this couldn't exist in the Batman or in Nolan's world. Your Catwoman again has to sort of make sense. And right. Tim Burton's not really interested in the world where a guy dresses up like a bat and is fighting villains named the Joker, the Penguin, Catwoman, Clayface, whatever, what have you. Making sense isn't the point. Making the story is the point. And the movie just assumes that's what I think this Batman does well. Instead of giving you a lot of origins and trying to steep it into reality, it just says you're in this world and these are the players in it.
So one thing that Nolan doesn't have, Batman 2 doesn't have, but this film has, is a hidden gem I like to call Jack Palance.
Oh, baby. It's an important job. I need someone I can trust. You are my number one guy. Now, don't forget. You're lucky, Dak.
Has there ever been an actor more breathy than Jack Palance?
He is like the acting equivalent of like Kenny Loggins in some of his slower music. Like, they're just so impossibly breathy.
It's like breathing for 4 men. You know, like that he's using the word sugar bumps. I don't think I've ever heard that anywhere else, but why not?
His death scene is so incredibly Jack Palance-y. I like how Burton creates this like noir approach. It's fantastical at the same time. It's just really just, it's so fun to look at. And that's one of the things that I think is where I think I also kind of maybe other Batman movies, they're so dreary because, they're trying to make Gotham this, Gotham tries to take a mind of its own. But in this case, I mean, Gotham is much, it feels like a character.
So much so that there's a few scenes, just a couple. When you first are introduced to Batman, his shadow is almost claymation.
Yeah, it's definitely animated.
Like the shadow is like a stop motion kind of shadow. And then when the Joker finally falls to his death, when he's plummeting down the side of the building, he almost becomes a cartoon about halfway down.
Yeah.
And it's almost like Burton is sort of like, I really want to use claymation at some point. But it's just a little wink.
Yeah, it definitely feels like it comes off the pages of a comic book more so than some of the other ones. I like that there's an art gallery where you can get spaghetti and cake.
At the same time, can have your wife order one and you can order the other.
I mean, that happens sometimes, when we can't decide between something like, hey, you order that, I'll order that, we'll share. I just never thought of getting spaghetti and cake simultaneously.
I like the idea that they're sharing bites.
Yeah, I like the idea, too, that there's, like, maybe 7 people that can dine there at any given time.
I love that art scene.
It's great. I was watching this, and my daughter came in while we were watching, and she's seen this movie a bunch, too. And I was explaining to her that, at one point, this was considered a very controversial scene because some people were very upset that the Joker was defacing all this art.
He defaces faces.
Yeah, right? That's not a problem.
Thank you. horror,